This place evokes great memories. It was a gift to us in our community to really try to find that space to reflect expressions of Black experience. I just knew that the environment, what I saw these young African Americans doing, was a place I needed to be.
What is my Schomburg Center? I'm standing here at the Cosmogram, which underneath holds the ashes of the poet Langston Hughes. On the evening when this Cosmogram was dedicated, people began to empty out of the auditorium. A jazz trio struck up. And to my amazement, Amira Baraka went over and asked Maya Angelou for a dance. And they started to dance on top of the Cosmogram, on top of the ashes of Langston Hughes. And I felt what a fitting way to kiss the memory of Langston.
Good evening. How are you? It's great to see such a full house here. We are thrilled to have you here. My name is Brian Jones. I'm the Associate Director of Education here at the Schomburg Center, and it's my honor to welcome you here to this incredible place that you've just learned something about. Tonight's program is the third event in the seventh season of a very special series that we put on here called Conversations in Black Freedom Studies. It's a series produced by my department, the Education Department, and it's curated by two professors whom you'll meet soon, Jean Theo Harris and Kamozi Woodard. By show of hands, how many people here have been to Conversations in Black Freedom Studies before? Okay, pretty good. How many people are new? This is the first time you've ever been to one of these events. Okay, fantastic. Well, we hope you keep coming back. They are the first Thursday of every month, same place and same time through May. And if you grab a catalog on your way out, you'll see some of the upcoming events in the series. Whether you're new or whether you're returning, I think for many of us, tonight's gathering feels special, not only because we're on the eve of an election, but in many ways it feels that we're on the precipice of disaster. Everywhere we look, basic human rights are threatened, civil and political rights are trampled, and racism and inequality seem more intractable than ever. Dr. King asked whether, in 1968, we were headed toward chaos or community. And 50 years later, the answer, unfortunately, seems to be that we are hurtling closer to the former and getting further away from the latter. But if there is a ray of hope, it is that increasingly it seems like in different parts of the world and right here, people are coming together and trying to find ways to organize themselves and fight back. And perhaps we can see tonight as one small step in that direction towards building community in the face of all this chaos. And it's in that spirit that I welcome you, those of you who have gathered here today, those who are following along at home via our live stream. And if you want to send this live stream to somebody who should be following along at home, please just Google Schomburg space live stream. And that is the link, and you can forward it on to anyone who should be listening to this. And we are incredibly fortunate to be joined in this endeavor, guided in this discussion tonight, by three renowned scholars and activists, Dr. Gloria Brown Marshall, Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, and Reverend Dr. William Barber. They're all here. Following their presentations, there will be an opportunity for questions and dialogue with the audience. We have microphones, two microphones at the back of the room, and Kamozi Woodard will moderate that discussion. So please use the microphones when that time comes. And at the end of that question and answer and dialogue period, we're going to have a book signing. And the books will be, and the authors will be, directly out of this door in the Langston Hughes lobby, just outside of this auditorium. So if you haven't already, please pick up Gloria Brown Marshall's book, The Voting Rights War, the NAACP and the Ongoing Struggle for Justice. Liz Theo Harris's Always With Us, What Jesus Really Said About the Poor. And Reverend William Barber's book, The Third Reconstruction, Moral Mondays, Fusion Politics, and the Rise of a New Justice Movement. Now, one small request for you all before I stop speaking, which is out of respect for the limited human energies of our presenters who've been so kind to make the time to be here. When the program concludes, please do not crowd the front of the stage, because we need to escort them on to the next phase of their evening, which is book signing, and then on to their homes and their loved ones, just like we all want to get home at the end of a long day. So please help us in that endeavor by parting yourselves and allowing them to pass to the book signing. We really appreciate it. The New York City Charter Commission, I just need to mention, you may have seen them with a table. New York City's charter is basically New York City's constitution. It controls the government, determines taxes, and that sort of thing. And in November of 2019, there's going to be an opportunity for people to vote on a new charter. So if you see that table with the New York City Charter Commission on your way out, if you want to get more information about how you can raise your voice or speak up about this or that aspect of New York City's charter, feel free to speak with the people at that table on your way out. Please also remember to, bless you, please also remember to silence your NSA tracking devices. The Schomburg Center, the Schomburg Center does not permit you to use those devices for flash photography nor to video record tonight's program. So if you're doing any video recording, please stop. And as I said, when the time comes, please use the microphones at the back to address our guests. And without further ado, please join me in welcoming Jean Theo Harris to introduce tonight's program.
Good evening. Okay, we can do better than that. Good evening. All right. Welcome. I was backstage, so I didn't get to see how many people have been to Conversations in Black Freedom Studies before. Okay, welcome. So I'm Professor Jean Theo Harris. I teach at Brooklyn College, and Professor Kamozi Woodard, who teaches at Sarah Lawrence, and I started this series 7 years ago, in part because there were fewer and fewer spaces, public spaces, where we could come together and hear new work in Black history and talk and think about how that history helps us think about today. Bookstores were closing, and so the Schomburg seemed like the place historically that that has happened. And so we began this series, as Brian Jones of the Schomburg was saying, it is the first Thursday of every month. We will be here in December. Our program is on Black politics of sports. So, and we'll be here in the spring. We have an amazing sort of lineup in the spring as well. So please join us. We are so happy to have you here tonight. When we planned this over the summer, we obviously planned this conversation to happen 6 days before Election Day, but I think it is feeling even more urgent and even more necessary than it was when we decided to do this summer. Certainly this has been a very dark week in a very dark month. And so it is so good to be together tonight to talk, to listen, and in many ways to have Professor Gloria Brown Marshall, Reverend Liz Theo Harris, and Reverend Barber with us to show us kind of the way forward and to show us the long history of the struggle for voting rights. Now, many of you may know this is a particularly special night for me because Reverend Liz Theo Harris is my sister, and so I'm particularly proud tonight to be sharing the stage with her. Her and Reverend Barber and people across the country have built a new Poor People's Campaign in the spirit and taking on the legacy of the first Poor People's Campaign that Martin Luther King and Coretta Scott King put forward. And so in many ways, I think they show us not just what we're reacting against, but what we are for. And Professor Gloria Brown Marshall, I think, gives us really a roadmap of sort of the struggle for voting rights. I think in the past few weeks, somehow the media has discovered kind of the voting rights issues that people like Professor Brown Marshall have been writing about and showing us for years. So please join me in welcoming Professor Gloria Brown Marshall, Reverend Liz Theo Harris, and Reverend William Barber.
Thank you so much, and I am so honored to be here. As you can imagine, that I am on this stage. The Schomburg means so much to me. It was at the Schomburg probably about 10 to 12 years ago that I used to speak with the young people who would come in on Saturdays in that program. And then over time, I would talk about constitutional law. And those of you who know me know I'm kind of geeky when it comes to the Constitution, that you know that. And that I cover the US Supreme Court and I do legal commentary. But I also do legal history. And I'm going to say some things today, and I always like to put them in the context of history because we weren't there when these things happened. Unlike Hamilton, if you were in the room when it happened, you would be about 250 years old. But I must say you look marvelous for your age. I want to greet all of you and, of course, greet those on the panel as well. I am just beyond honored because to be in this place with these panelists is an amazing thing. To be able to speak with you, this is New York City, you could be anywhere. And you're here today, and that's amazing. I want us to talk about the fact that we're in a situation, in a struggle for power. And that's why the title of my book is A Voting Rights War, because there's a war over power. Now, I'm going to say some things people who are proponents of nonviolence may not say, but that's the balance and diversity of this panel. So let's just look at this for a moment, because we're talking about power. And I want to make sure we're clear, because I've had certain people, some women, say, we shouldn't say power, we should say empowered, because power is so male. Yes. Power is just that. It is the ability to make change, to force your vision onto the scene, wherever that scene is, be it a family, a community, a country. The vote is power. And for those people who say, I don't want to vote because it doesn't matter anyway, if your vote was worthless, they wouldn't try to steal it from you. If your vote was worthless, they would not have voter suppression laws and tactics that they know almost to the individual count how each obstacle will make people fall away from voting, fall away from registration, fall away from participating. So when we look at power, I want us to look at something that maybe we could better understand when we think about the power of the civil rights movement. And as I said, these giants are going to go into the actual civil rights movement. I study it. I try to claim I wasn't young enough to be there. Here's what I want us to understand about this. It's always been about power. Mm-hmm. And people may say, well, God is going to help us, and God will, but I believe it says watch and pray. Mm-hmm. My concern is that from the very beginning of this struggle, and I want you to know, in heaven, everybody will get to vote. Down here, you're going to have to fight for it because it is a war. And every now and then, a battle will percolate to the top. It'll be extremely bloody, extremely awful, twisted, and that will make the news. That will make our vision of what a battle is, and then it'll die down a little and it'll rise up again. But what we're dealing with now with photo ID, which began in Indiana, you know, your VP Pence's state, is nothing more than the poll tax in a different guise. We have to look at what this is. When you follow the arc, you'll see that almost 400 years ago, this battle began. And I like to very quickly go through this type of legal history. Because in 1607, the Jamestown colony was formed in Virginia. It was dying out. And in 1619, 20 Africans arrived in that colony. This must be understood because in 1620, the Mayflower landed. We were here before the Mayflower. Within that group of Africans who were arriving into the Jamestown colony, we have these two, a couple, the first couple, not Barack Obama and Michelle. No, this first African couple from Angola, Mary and Anthony Johnson. Of course, their name was not that when they were in Angola. But here's what you should understand about this. In that colony, in order for one to vote, they had to own land. And that's why to this day, follow the dot, those who are homeowners get better things. Their sense of investment is different from somebody who might be traveling through to rent. Mary and Anthony Johnson, these Angolans, in 1600s, Jamestown, Virginia, bought their freedom, owned land, servants of their own, white and black, in the 1600s. Then it's time to vote, right? The law changes, saying you're aliens in this colony, and force them out taking their land. So they would not have that political power. That is the pattern that follows us constantly through this travail. They say these are the rules. We then meet those rules, and as soon as it's time to exercise the political power, the rules then change. And if the rules don't change themselves outright, then you have violence and mayhem. So this has been this democracy, this so-called nation on a hill, shining example. This example has always had these other counter influences in it. And as you follow through, you will see this has happened time and time again. The economic power of the African-American community is over $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion a year, over that, reaching in the next 2 years, $1.5 trillion. That economic power then translates into political power, social power, educational power. But we're in a paradigm in which it's determined that there should be white supremacy rule. Now, what gets me is when I think of my friends, my brothers and sisters, European Americans, I want them to say, not in my name. Not in my name do you crush people because they are gaining a population that could, by 2045, make this nation majority people of color. Or as the Native Americans say, back like it was. Mm-hmm. We also have this now, this sense of the black woman's political power. We're seeing that people of African descent from the time period of 1870, when black men gained the right to vote, have been able to change the outcome of an election. Mm-hmm. Since 1870, African Americans have been able to change the outcome of an election by voting, or we see in this case, not voting. That is power, and it was understood in the 1870s what that power was. And that's why the grandfather clause was created that said if your grandfather didn't vote, you couldn't vote. That's why the poll tax was created that said you had to pay a poll tax in order for you to register to vote. That's why the literacy test was created, and it was already in place for Catholic Irish. They already knew if we had a test that one had to pass before they could register to vote. And they used certain questions on that test that were not within that cultural sphere, then you would probably fail it. That had been used early on the Irish Catholics. That literacy test in 1890, Mississippi Constitutional Convention, then created a literacy test for African Americans. When we start going through how we go forward, two steps forward, one step back, what happened with women, African-American women, like all women, gained their right to vote with the 19th Amendment. By December of that year, 1920, there were already acts of violence against black women. Mm. The power of that black female vote was obvious. Two things are happening here. Our progressive European-American brothers and sisters need to realize we are worthy allies in search of worthy allies. Our African American and other communities of color, you need to understand the power that you hold. If you don't understand that power, you won't know how to wield that power, and you would need to understand how to best use the power in the future because other people know you have this power. And when we come together, which is what has always happened, the ability to weld us or drive us apart and weld us to these different issues outside of our communities. So when we come together, there is such power there. But as they force us apart, and say, no, you should go over here. What did Brett Kavanaugh say when he looked in that camera? He said, think of your sons. Think of your husbands. Think of your fathers. Who was he talking to? White women and white men. That's how it works. Is that subtle or not? So when we think of the overarching power, we need to keep this in mind. By the year 2045, this country is going to be majority people of color. Other people understand that, and that's why they're doing what they're doing right now. One of the major issues we have in the Constitution is the first line of the 14th Amendment gives citizenship at birth. What comes with citizenship?
Voting rights.
Voting rights.
That's right.
What did he say he was going to do? Sign an executive order taking away citizenship at birth. All of this has been taking place over many, many years. It's not new. We have this man in the White House because we had a black man in there earlier. This is the backlash that came from progress. But I want you to know, strategically, there will always be a backlash that follows progress. We can never just sit back. One thing that I want to leave you with, I want to leave you with a quote, actually two quotes. One from President Lyndon Johnson. Now, depending on how you see yourself in the world, you have an opinion on President Lyndon Johnson. But one thing he did was he pushed through the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Lives were lost for that legislation. And in his speech on the television that day when he pushed forward, he mentioned this, something that we should understand. And this is the power that the African-American protest had in that time period. He said, and I quote, "The real hero of this struggle is the American Negro. His actions in protest, his courage to risk safety and even to risk his life have awakened the conscience of this nation. His demonstrations have been designed to call attention to injustice, designed to provoke change, designed to stir reform," end quote. He knew the power of the African-American civil rights movement. Few people have ever said to people of African descent, you know, you guys did a great job. You were so courageous. You were amazing. There are nations across the world who are using violence to get the very things that the African Americans achieved during that civil rights movement. And yet, because it's us, people do not give the credit where credit is due. Meaning we don't understand the true power then and don't understand the true power now. So how can we prepare for the power that will be handed to us in 2044 and 2045? We need to understand and be aware. If we don't recognize our power, we'll lose it, we'll abuse it, or we may end up in an apartheid state. None of this is beyond the reckoning of people who believe that their position and authority should be the only position. That battle has been going on since the beginning of this nation, even before, with Mary and Anthony Johnson and all those who came and said, I want to be a full citizen in this nation, under the Constitution of this nation. And there is a voting rights martyr, that's what I call them, voting rights martyrs. And his name is Vernon Damer. Vernon Damer, while dying of his burns from a firebomb in Mississippi, decided no matter what, his life, he knew, was leaving him. On his tombstone, after he succumbed to his wounds, just registering people to vote in Mississippi was a death sentence for him. On his headstone, the words to this day, if you don't vote, you don't count. Thank you.
We must be honest, about the foundations of the political and economic systems we call America. I love America because of her potential, but I know that America will never even get close to being a more perfect nation until we are honest about the politics of rejection.
I want to tell you about some of the leaders who are building the Poor People's Campaign. Callie Greer from Selma, Alabama, who had to bury her daughter, Venus, because she didn't have health care.
I'm here today to share my daughter's Venus's story. Venus discovered a small lump in her breast and she wasn't insured. Venus had to be approved for every prescription and every piece of medical equipment that she needed. I'm standing here today in solidarity with the Poor People's Campaign because no one should have to bury their child in America because they don't have health care insurance.
I'm 46 years old. I've lived in poverty here in West Virginia every day of my life. And I'm working. I am working poor with a bachelor's degree. I'm doing the best I can with what I have.
I'm a second generation fast food worker and I've experienced the cycle of poverty firsthand. Growing up, I watched my mother endure long hours of back-breaking labor, doing everything she could to feed me and my sisters. My employer barely pays me enough to pay rent and utilities, let alone with the medical expenses with my mother.
I worked 41 years in the coal mines. I have black lung, and it's just unfathomable what these poor coal miners have to go through in order to get what they have worked for and deserve.
I'm a Vietnam veteran. My only chance of going to college was joining the Army.
It was one thing to know that you didn't have water and you couldn't afford your water. It's a whole nother to find out that they shut off your entire community and none of you matter.
But when I lost my housing, healthcare, and income all at the same time, I was terrified, panicked.
Hi, my name is Pamela Rush. I'm from Niles County, Alabama. And I live in a mobile home with my two kids. And I got raw sewage. I don't have no money. I'm poor. And I had to travel back and forth to Birmingham to take my daughter with the CPAP machine. Don't have a car and don't have no way to take her.
This is the largest encampment in Aberdeen. There's about 1,000 people in a town of 16,000 who are homeless.
In my community, we were all shut off for the day because none of us could afford our water bills. In the past, my family wasn't able to afford electricity in the winter. It was very hard on all of us.
This wall. This is sin of the highest order.
When there are 38 million poor children, when 60% of African Americans are poor, when 65% of Latinx are poor, when 40% of Asians are poor, when there are 67 million poor white people, we must say, this is not right.
Good evening.
Good evening.
It's an honor to be with you this evening, but I have to say I'm here, as all of us are, with a very heavy heart. These are hard, these are dangerous times. Systemic racism and poverty, ecological devastation, militarism, and this distorted moral narrative. A narrative that blames us, the people, for our problems, that pits us against each other and claims that there's not enough to go around when we're living in a world of abundance. So this evening we're looking at the connection between voting rights, and why historically and today people have come together to say we need a Poor People's Campaign.
We need a national moral revival in this land. You see, voter suppression, and we're living with fewer voting rights today than we did 53 years ago. Racist voter suppression has a consistent negative impact on all of the nation's poorest residents. The states that rank highest in ecological devastation, the states that are sending the most people off to fight in war, the states with the highest levels of poverty, the lowest wages, the least health care, are the states where our votes are being suppressed and stolen from. So 50 years ago, Dr. Martin Luther King called for a poor people's campaign. And he worked with the National Welfare Rights Organization, the Highlander Folk School, the United Farm Workers, the Puerto Rican Human Rights Alliance, and many different coalitions of groups to say that the Achilles heel of racism, poverty, and militarism was for the poor of all colors and creeds to come together, organize together, struggle together, and vote together. He said, "The dispossessed of this nation, the poor, both white and Negro, live in a cruelly unjust society. They must organize a revolution, not against the people, but against the structures through which the society is refusing to take means, which have been called for and which are at hand to lift the load of poverty. There are millions of poor people in this country who have very little or even nothing to lose. If they can be helped to take action together, they will do so with a freedom and a power that will be a new and unsettling force in our complacent national life. Beginning in the new year, we will be recruiting thousands of the poorest citizens from different urban and rural areas to initiate and lead a sustained, massive, direct action movement." He said that 50 years ago. But today, 50 years later, we're living in a cruel, unjust society. When 250,000 people in the U.S. die each year because of poverty and low wealth, it's a cruel and unjust society. We know that we're living in a country that is refusing to take means which have been called for and which are at hand, when there's not one town, not one city, not one county in this entire country where someone who's working full-time at the federal minimum wage can afford a two-bedroom apartment. But you can make a house in 45 minutes. They can 3D print houses now. But we have untold homelessness. We know we must lift the load of poverty when there are almost 15 million people in this country who can't afford water, when there are tens of millions without health care, and 3/4 of the people who have health care in this country still have to choose between medical care and paying their other bills. when there are 62 million people in this country who are living and working at less than a living wage? We know that there are millions of poor people in this country who have very little or even nothing to lose, because the statistics tell us that there are 140 million people who are poor and low income in the richest country in the world, at the richest moment in history, almost 50%. And so this means it's our duty. It means it's our call, our responsibility to then take action together. In times as these, we're compelled to stand up. As you saw in the video, we've been traveling around the country. And when in Lowndes County, Alabama, where the Black Panther Party was born, people are living, families are living in 2018 with raw sewage in their yards. And it's not the only community where that's going on. We're compelled to stand up. When in Aberdeen, Washington, 1 in 15 people are homeless. And when kids are being taken away in Detroit because they don't have water, in El Paso because of unjust immigration, or in North Carolina, like we were in this week, because of just being too poor. Can we answer that I linked arms, I stood up, I built a movement, and I voted? The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, launched this past spring. And from Mother's Day to the summer solstice, tens of thousands of people in 40 states across the country committed ourselves to a season of direct action. For 6 consecutive weeks, we gathered at state capitals and in Washington, D.C., and engaged in the largest and most expansive wave of nonviolent civil disobedience in this country's history. More than just a series of rallies and actions, this new model of organizing is being catalyzed across the country. From Alaska to Alabama, from California to the Carolinas, people are coming together to organize a moral revolution against poverty and racism, ecological devastation, militarism, and the war economy. And now we're in the next phase of building that movement. It's a phase of registering people for a movement, signing up people for a movement, organizing people for a movement that will vote. Because we know that we could be a new and unsettling force. We've been carrying out hearings across the country. And so I can bring you greetings from cattle ranchers in Missouri, family farmers in Kansas, undocumented immigrants in Wisconsin, homeless parents in North Carolina, folks facing ecological devastation in Virginia, and say that the impossible is happening, that people are coming together across race and geography in order to organize a movement. And we're here to say that you need to be part of it. So as we go in to our next presenter, we want to show one more video from the Poor People's Campaign, A National Call for Moral Revival.
Our brothers and sisters are sleeping on the streets. For a country this rich to have so many people poor, it's immoral and it's wrong.
Our backs are against the wall, and we got no choice but to push.
Follow that breaking news in Albany, where a large group of protesters have moved into the street.
Washington Avenue between City Hall and Lark Street closed down.
Protesters with the Poor People's Campaign of Indiana.
2 o'clock on the East Coast, 2 o'clock in the middle, 2 o'clock on the West Coast. A wave, and the historians tell us it's never happened before.
Our communities, Muslim communities, who have joined the Poor People's Campaign, you can count on us.
Our democracy is in trouble.
Our democracy is in trouble.
And we come to demand.
And we come to demand.
Second warning.
Because it's crucial that we make ourselves heard. No one is listening. We write letters, we make calls. No one is listening. So we gotta find a way to make ourselves heard.
We are the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. And we are here. We are poor. We are clergy. And we're here to say to our nation's capital and to the highest court in this land that everybody has a right to live. Everybody has a right to learn. Everybody has a right to love. Everybody has a right to living wages. Everybody has a right to vote. Everybody has a right to thrive in this society.
Everybody say,
I believe that we will win.
I believe that we will win.
I believe that we will win.
He don't fight, and he taught us how to fight.
The poor and the clergy. We read Article 6 of the Kentucky State Constitution that says we have a right to free assembly.
We are demanding that we stop the war on our poor.
There will be a movement that will break through the con and bring people together to save the heart and the soul of this democracy and this world.
So let me ask you to please, after you clap and after tonight, to go to poorpeoplescampaign.org and sign up and join up with the movement. It is a privilege and an honor to be here. Let's give it up for these two sister warriors. Yeah. Amen. 17 days after the March on Washington, four girls were in Sunday school and they were blown up and 20 other people were injured. When Dr. King went to do one of the eulogies, he suggested that we should be concerned not with who set the bomb, but what created the atmosphere for the bombs to be set in the first place. He said every politician that continues to feed their constituencies the stale bread and the spoiled meat of racism. Every Negro that has sat silently on the sidelines and not challenged injustice. And every preacher that has stayed behind their stained glass windows and not dealt with the issues of injustice. He said it's not so much who killed her, but what philosophy, what attitude. Well, just last week, we were on the precipice in this country. I wonder sometimes if people really understand where we are right now, where we could have been. We had not seen a simultaneous assassination attempt like we saw last week since 1865, when Abraham Lincoln was killed and there was an attempt to wipe out the rest of his cabinet. We hadn't seen a simultaneous attack like that since Birmingham, when bombs were set off one right after the other. We could have had two presidents and first ladies gone, a vice president gone, two African Americans, one female, one male, senators gone, three potential candidates for the presidency in 2020, a senior intelligence officer, two major philanthropists, a congressperson, and an entire newsroom. And then we had also two African Americans that were shot in Kroger because the killer couldn't get into church and kill more people, where we're actually headed tomorrow, to Kentucky. And then we had 11 souls killed in a church called a synagogue called Tree of Life. And it became a lynching by AK-47. And now we know that the perpetrators, the atmosphere that was created, the radicalization of them, has been created by all of this rhetoric, all of this meanness that's coming from the highest level, a president in some ways, people who enable him or will not challenge him, and crowds that cheer him. And we have this president because of 77,000 votes. 100 million people stayed home that did not vote. 3 million more people voted against him than voted for him. 4.5 million people actually voted against him if you count all of the votes for other candidates. But 77,000 votes and a racist electoral college that's been in existence far too long. 77,000 votes. He won, they say, Wisconsin by 30,000 votes. 250,000 votes were suppressed in Wisconsin, black and white. He won Michigan by 10,000 votes, and they say 100,000 African Americans that were registered to vote did not vote. He won in North Carolina. North Carolina had 154 fewer voting sites in this election than we had in 2012. 2.5 million people that could have voted and registered stayed home. He won North Carolina by less than 200,000 votes in the midst of a season where we just ended a four-year fight against voter suppression. And so 77,000 votes gave us complete madness in our political structure. 77,000 votes. That's where we are in 2018. But it's been America's story. Ever since the Constitution, there were some who said there are certain people that ought not vote, poor white people, white men without land, Native Americans, women, and black people. 1870 was when the 15th Amendment, and ever since the 15th Amendment and the 14th Amendment were written, the deconstructors of democracy have always feared black and poor white people voting together and hooking up. And it didn't always start in the South, because I want you to know I am in one of the worst voter suppression states tonight. All these people in New York, and even with a Democratic legislature, you don't have but one day to vote. In North Carolina, I got 15. You don't have same-day registration and early voting. We fought for it and won it. They took it. We fought for it and got it back. But there's always been this fear wherever there are mass numbers of black and brown and poor white people that have the potential to come together. Dr. King in 1965 said that at the end of the Selma to Montgomery March, the speech you ought to read, if you don't read any of his other speeches, is really read that speech at the end of the Selma to Montgomery. In some ways, it's better than I Have a Dream in terms of how detailed he was and what the problems were. And there are several others. 1965, the Voting Rights Act passed August 6th. And it was necessary to protect and stop states from constantly trying not just to stop the black vote, but to hinder the fusion between poor blacks and poor whites and Latinos. It said that and I want you to know that ever since August 6, 1965, any state that could stop voter suppression for 10 years could have been removed from the coverage of the Voting Rights Act pre-clearance. All they had to do was stop for 10 years. And for 50 years, no state that was originally under it has been able to resist. Instead, they've gotten worse and worse. 1968, particularly, as the Poor People's Campaign was being assassinated with the killing of Dr. King, the Southern strategy was being raised up by Richard Nixon to create what they call positive polarization. Kevin Phillips told Richard Nixon that we can find out who hates who and play them against each other. And along with voter suppression, we can lock up the country by locking up the South and the ethnic enclaves of the North. So we've had voter suppression. It's not just photo ID, gerrymandering, resisting voter same-day registration, early voting, resisting making it legal to automatically register people at 18 since you automatically register them to go to war at 18. Mm-hmm. Election as a holiday. All designed in many ways to make sure that black and brown and white people cannot find these fusion coalitions. And it did not start with Donald Trump. We talk too much about Trump. I get bothered when folks say this is the era of Donald Trump. I'm a preacher. This is the era of God. This is never an era of any one person. Now Trump is a problem, but he's a symptom. He's not the disease. He's kind of, what he does over and over again is kind of like, when you have a cold, you sneeze and stuff comes out. That's the symptom. But you don't treat that. You wipe that. You treat what's inside. Before Donald Trump ever became president in 2010, 26 states had passed voter suppression laws in America. Hear this. Those 26 states represented 52 United States senators, more than half of the United States House of Representatives, 54% of all African-American voters. That was 2010. He was dealing birtherism stuff, right? He wasn't even talking about running. June 25th, 2013 was the day the Supreme Court gutted in a 5-4 decision the Voting Rights Act and basically undermined pre-clearance. But watch what they did. First of all, it was a 5-4 decision. Second of all, they threw it to the Congress and they said the House of Representatives could fix it. They have been sitting, Ryan, Boehner, and McConnell have been sitting on fixing the Voting Rights Act for 1,055 days, 5 years and 4 months. Now, understand what that means. Strom Thurmond was considered a racist because he filibustered the Civil Rights Act of 57 for one day. Ryan, McConnell, and Boehner have filibustered, have engaged in a modern-day interposition nullification for 1,055 days and counting. One of the most racist, underreported acts that we have seen. And the media now is talking, Gene, about voter suppression, but as though it's like new just because it's happening in Georgia with Stacey Abrams. No. And this is happening at the very time that if you register 30% of the unregistered blacks in the South and they connect with progressive whites and poor working class whites that want to go forward and brown people, you could literally turn North Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, Florida, and Virginia over. Now, why is that important? Because the first goal of voter suppression is to lock down the 13 former Confederate states from Maryland to Texas. Why? Because if you can control from Maryland to Texas, you control over 171 electoral votes just by controlling 13 states, which means you only need 99 electoral votes from the other 37 states. You can control 26 U.S. senators by controlling the former 36 Confederate states, and you only need 25 from the other 37 states to control the United States Senate. You can control 31% of the United States House of Representatives by controlling 13 states, which means you only need 20% from the other 37 states. You can control this country by controlling the states that only have 23% of the voting population, the national population. So the goal has been first to lock down those states. And the problem has not just been Republicans. Democrats have given up the South While Republicans have taken the South because they understand the numbers, and they know, though, they cannot win those states without voter suppression. Without voter suppression. Now, here's the other hook, and Liz alluded to it. All of the states that have passed voter suppression laws have elected politicians who cut taxes for the wealthy, who take health care, who are against workers' rights, who are against insurance, against immigrants, against gay people, and cut public education. They all get elected somewhat because of racialized voter suppression. But when they get in office, they pass policies that hurt mostly white people. You didn't hear what I just said? You hear what I said? They all get elected by racialized voter suppression, but they pass policies that hurt mostly white people, and that is why a true revolutionary movement, a campaign, cannot just be a black movement. It has to be a black, brown movement, white, that takes race and poverty together, that sees racism, systematic poverty, ecological devastation, health care, the war economy, and the false moral narrative of Christian nationalism, all as five interlocking injustices. Now, I know that you all are smart up here at the Schomburg, and you say, oh, this old country preacher from down south, he doesn't know what he talked about. He didn't go to Columbia. You know, he didn't go to one of these fancy northern schools. So there's some maps, so you can not take it from me. These are all the states that have done voter suppression, have some form. Notice New York should be green up there. Is it? Okay. Those are all the states that have engaged since 2010. Next slide. These are the high poverty states. Same states. Next slide. High child poverty states. Same slide. Next. Women in poverty. The same states that engage in racialized voter suppression have the worst numbers for women. I didn't say black women, women. I didn't say black children, I said children. Because when a child is hungry, black or white, they don't cry black or white, they cry pain. If you are white or you are black or you are red or you're yellow or you're brown and you don't have enough money to pay your light bill, we all black in the dark. So we got to have this conversation. Next slide. Next slide. Every state that refused Medicaid expansion is also a voter suppression state where the people that got elected didn't win. They got elected because of voter suppression and racialized gerrymandering. And once they got the power, they then used that power to block Medicaid expansion. And in all those southern states you see there, from Virginia all the way down to Texas, guess what? The majority of the people that would have benefited from Medicaid expansion are white. In my state, out of the 500,000, 346,000 are white. And progressives made a mistake two ways. Number one, they bought a trick. It was trick or treat. When they called it Obamacare, progressives should have resisted that. Obama should have resisted. They said, no, I'm not going to put a call. They didn't call Social Security, Roosevelt Security, because that was a way of racializing it. But secondly, too much of the discussion about the Affordable Care Act happened in the North and in the Rust Belt, and it should have come down south. Next slide. The states without living wages, same states, the voter suppression states. Next slide. States that lack LGBTQ non-discrimination law, same states. Next slide. So my point is, my brothers and sisters, what we're trying to teach people and what we have to show is that this fight for voting rights is a fight for power, but it's also a fight to disable the democracy, not destroy it, disable it enough so it can be robbed. It's not trying to destroy the democracy, disable the democracy enough so that an oligarch, or what King called the bourbon class in 1965, can rob the democracy and unconstitutionally constitute our state legislatures and Congress and the presidency in a way to control the power, right? We didn't win the last, didn't lose the last election. It was stolen. And it's only been three times in history when a president, for instance, didn't win the popular vote but won the presidency. Rutherford B. Hayes in 1877. When he won it, then they gave him the Electoral College. He had the promise to turn the South back over to the races and to embrace voter suppression laws and to stack the Supreme Court. George Bush, the Chad, he didn't win it. He lost. He was selected. We ended up in war in Afghanistan where we spent $900 billion, and we're still not out of that war yet, and it's an unwinnable war. And now Trump and his cohorts in the Senate, 16 to 18 seats in the United States House of Representatives that would not be in the partisan camp they're in but for racialized gerrymandering. Every time we put a president in office who did not win the popular vote, it turned out bad. Voter suppression and economic injustice, as King would say, is inextricably linked with ecological devastation, the war economy, and the false moral narrative of religious and Christian nationalism. But inside of all of that ugly news is good news. And the good news is right now, what we need to do is overwhelm the ballot box. And if progressives ever get power again, they better have some backbone. We are not going to stand for progressives getting power again and then they won't restore the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. We cannot stand for progressives getting power again and they not vote to make Election Day a national holiday and the people are automatically registered at 18 and that we have standards across the country so that every state has same-day registration and early voting. We cannot have progressives get elected again by the people and they not open up the franchise of voting to the people. Because my sister is right, we are in a war for the soul of this country. But when you mess with voting rights, it's a blood war. Because every right that we have came through blood. The blood of the martyrs, the blood of those who died. The first person that died, Liz, after the march from Selma to Montgomery was not a black person. It was a white woman, Viola Wusa, driving black men back to Selma. And we have to get just a tad bit, I don't want to say violent, but tad bit angry. Just a tad. You don't have to sin, but just get a tad bit angry. And what I mean by that is anybody who's white or black or brown or Asian or yellow, and you have some great-great-grandparents who fought for justice and fought for voting rights, whenever people mess with those voting rights, that's like going down to your grandmama's grave, digging up her bones, and desecrating them. And you ought not act just nice about that. You ought to be concerned about that. All across this nation, we ought to say to folk, you can pick on us about health care. You can pick on us about other thing, but when you pick a fight about our voting rights, you don't even realize what you have done. You don't even realize what you have stirred up. You don't even realize who you messing with, because now you're messing with grandma, as we say down south, and granddaddy, and don't nobody mess with my grandmama and my granddaddy. And if they won the right with less, with less they beat Jim Crow, with less they beat the KKK, with less they beat all of these things, and they didn't have Twitter and social media and all of the stuff that we have, with less they won, sure by God, as much as we have, we can determine that we are not going to stand down, not now, not ever.
Amen. So should we have a sheet of paper where people can sign up tonight?
What's the website? Yeah, we...
PoorPeople'sCampaign.org.
PoorPeople'sCampaign.org.
Sign up right there.
All right. Okay, now we're going to do the questions and answers. Please line up at the microphone.
Uh-oh. This is the Schomburg.
Now, we're going to ask questions and not make speeches, though, right? So, questions.
Okay. Want more water?
Yeah. Thank you.
We're going to start to my right here.
Good evening. My name is Melanie McGann, and I'm so grateful to each and every one of you that are on the podium right now and in the chairs. This is actually a question for you, Reverend Barber. When I heard you speak at the Andrew Goodman Foundation, where you got the Hidden Heroes Award, you talked about May 1st and what you've done, and Reverend Theo Harris has just been remarkable. And you've stirred the pot, but the media still isn't covering you in the way that they need to cover you, because people don't understand the real impact that you have. And what is it that we can do? And I want to say that I am a member of the Poor People's Campaign. I do give money every month, small amount, but do give some. But what is it that we, sitting here in this room, can do?
Well, I'll take some of it, and certainly Liz, because she's a tremendous strategist and builder of movements. You can be a member paying or non-paying, in that sense that you can be donate and become part, or you not donate. So I want you all to join. We understand history. Nobody really paid attention to the first few days of the Montgomery movement, Rosa Parks. Nobody paid attention to the first Birmingham movement. It was a while. It was not like Dr. King did something and then all of a sudden, you know, the media was there. The media always catches up. So what we look at is the other side of it. Number one, we have 41 coordinating committees now. People are doing deep dive organizing, because if you're gonna be a tree that's gonna catch wind, you better make sure you got deep roots. And so they're going deep. They're canvassing communities that we don't normally canvass, and register people, and holding hearings where politicians have to come and listen and can't talk, but they have to hear from the people. We're planning some pretty big stuff coming. I won't talk about all of it tonight, because we are strategic. We don't put everything out there. But I will say to you, 38 million Twitter hits during that time, regardless of what the media said. 38 million. 3 million people followed us on video. The day we did the launch, there were 25,000 people there from all of the states saying that they would be the basis of a new movement. But they also, we also had about 2 million people on video. Liz and I both have 12 or so major denominations that didn't happen in 68. She's been overseas talking to groups that are involved. I've talked to 120 other countries. So the roots are being dug right now, right? So I want you to do like they used to say, keep your ear to the gourd, keep listening, right? And join and go online, and so that when we come out, because we got a couple of big things coming up and some other stuff in 219, 220, it's going to be massive. But more than it being massive, real change happens by what happens on the local level and what happens in these state legislatures, these state houses. And we operate from the Amos 5, where it says, God said, if I can just find the remnant. You know, sometimes we need to re-understand how we look at power. Mm-hmm. There's a book that says if you can get 3 to 7%, 3 to 7% of any country's population to engage and work simultaneously together, you can do transformative change. It's not, you don't need the 455 million, you know. And so we're trying to build deep and have leaderships deep and build up so that when we continue, but it's getting out there. And the fact of the matter is, even though we didn't get everything we want, those 6 weeks we hit every media market in this country. And we were on every media station. And it's beginning to pick up. It's beginning to pick up even more. So y'all join up and watch for the signs. And when you hear that it's time to ante up, join us. If you happen to hear that there's going to be this massive poor people's Congress, I'm just saying, I don't know what's going to happen, then or if you happen to hear around 220 that there's going to be a massive poor people's assembly with our own kind of Congress and General Assembly in the street of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, where poor people, not people speaking on their behalf, but impacted people are going to lay out their pain and their solutions. If you kind of hear that's going on, organize a bus.
My name is Beverly Copeland. In the post-war period, there have essentially been two forms of social welfare. One, the Dutch model, which de-incentivizes poverty, is a win-win. It's a win for the business community and the Dutch people. The people who would be poor are not poor. They live a comfortable existence. They are a relatively lucrative market for the business interests. They have housing, health care, transportation, you name it. The other end of the spectrum is the American model, where poverty is incentivized. There's no living wage. Often poor people, to get help from the government, have to self-destruct so they can get in programs for housing, et cetera. So I think the issue is that in America, poverty is incentivized and it has racial overtones. Would you comment on that? As opposed to the model, the Dutch model.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me put it this way. I used to work at legal services. And I remember as a legal services attorney being underfunded. And when we would make progress, there would be some undercutting of the budget. This sense that poor people have some type of personal problem. And that personal problem, poverty, is contagious. So they need to be isolated. Mm-hmm. That it's a matter of character defect. In this sense of, at the same time, we have a middle class afraid of being contaminated by the poor people's defect, disease, or character flaw. So you have a lot of people who believe in the isolation of the poor in this country. And then they buy into the American dream, where you have people of color who rise up and other ethnic groups who rise up, and the first thing they want to do is get as far away from the poor as possible to not be reminded. And so there are too many people in middle income who basically want a softer pillow in the prison and better hours on the plantation. So This idea of the scary poor is something that I always try to tell middle income people and higher. They outnumber you. They outnumber you. So when we start talking about voting rights and the coming together of these groups, what I want to see is a political action committee of the poor who then want to create or at least influence legislation in a way that's better for them. I mean, that's what I was told by somebody.
Oh, okay. I'll just teach.
But I want you to also think about another impact on poverty, and that's, we've talked about health care, but it's the criminal justice system. And this criminal justice system is also creating poverty. Yes, is the racial disparity and the poverty of those people who then are released and thrown out into society without the ability to earn a living or help their families. While they're incarcerated, their families are becoming impoverished. So this is an ongoing cycle where people are believing that it must be some character flaw that's creating poverty, which is not the Dutch model. They're not looking at it as a personal problem. They're looking at it as an economic, an employment, a structural, a societal problem. So it's the way you view poverty. When people said, and you tell me more than, and when they said the poor will always be among us, Jesus, as I believe it, was you know, making an exit really soon and said, I'm not going to be here for long, but the poor will always be among us. Now, I don't.
you got Liz riled up exactly. Now. She's going to tell you.
I know.
Talk to him, Liz.
I got a couple hundred pages on that.
I know. Jump in, Liz. Jump in.
I know. But the reason why I say it to get myself in trouble.
Yeah, you are in a lot of trouble right now, I'm telling you.
You know what? But I'm going to tell you, the reason why I'm bold enough to say it is because people have then fallen back on this sense that the poor will always be among us, so why should I do anything?
Right. Now that is,
that's yeah. Right.
So that's why I told you. Let me get that last part in. So and that's the American model.
Yeah.
So that's my concern when you're talking about poverty from this structural standpoint. The American model doesn't take into account the sense of self-destruction that a poor person is supposed to be taking on themselves. It has nothing to do with any outside forces, and that's completely untrue.
Right.
Well, I want Liz to deal with that, and I'm gonna say something, but I ain't. Go ahead.
No, I think bringing in this biblical text, right? So Jim Wallace, this evangelical, says that the poor will be with you always is the most famous passage in the entire Bible about poverty. People that don't know anything about the Bible know that passage. And people that know a lot about the Bible think that that is the text that says something about poverty, ignoring the 2,500 other passages that are about lifting up the poor, right? But when he says the poor will be with you always, he's quoting a different civilization, a different model. And I think this question around models is a really important one, right? So Deuteronomy 15 talks about how societies, how nations are supposed to be organized. And it says that there will be no needy among you as long as you follow the way that society should be organized that I'm telling you today. And that means paying people what they deserve.
That's right.
That means forgiving debts. That means releasing slaves. That means loaning out money knowing that you'll never get paid back. It's called the Sabbath prescriptions. It's kind of connected to the Jubilee. And this isn't about individuals. This is about nations. This is about how whole societies are supposed to be. So it says, there'll never be a needy person among you if you follow these things. Now, those are a totally different economic logic than we have in this country. The notion that if we pay people what they deserve, if we, you know, forgive debts, if we lend out money knowing we're never going to get it back, and if we get rid of a slave system that oppresses the majority, that then we'll have a prosperous economic society, right? And so it connects to how we can get out of this mess. What also connects with how we get out of this mess is solutions from the ground up. The Poor People's Campaign, A National Call for Moral Revival, has demands and principles and a platform. And I really encourage folks, if you aren't familiar, to familiarize yourselves with that. Because what we've done is put together, out of grassroots communities, out of the problems that are happening, what are the solutions? And they're not just solutions like, let's put a Band-Aid on it.
That's right.
They're not just solutions like, let's make it a little bit better for some people. It's solutions like, you know, automatic registration at the age of 18. It's solutions like single-payer universal health care. It's solutions like free education and supporting historically black colleges and universities. It's about, you know, all of these kinds of things that are possible. Yeah. They're visionary, but they're not out of our reach. And so I think that we have to talk about historical models, other country models, and then a model that's coming out of grassroots leaders today.
And I have to say something to this question, because we also are developing a budget. we're looking at some of the best economists that are hooking up with grassroots people, raising this question, what is the cost of keeping people poor?
Mm-hmm.
Right? What is mm-hmm. the cost? We're also changing the narrative and breaking through the racialized narrative by showing the numbers. See, because poverty was intentionally racialized after the very programs that helped lift up many white people in this country, and then the Nixon Southern strategy, all of that, the attempt was to racialize entitlement programs and then use that as a justification to say the poor and working class white, you are hurting because these people are getting free stuff, when in fact, more whites were getting these programs than blacks, and the fact of the matter is that was just a scapegoat to cut taxes and do trickle-down economics, right, and the oligarchs could get more.
Right.
So we know that's history. So what we're doing, why you saw these numbers, we don't allow anybody to say it's just 37 million people poor. We had the numbers really done, it's 140 million people. Mm-hmm. We deliberately don't just say 66% of all African Americans live in poverty because, and not say what the raw number is, because we want folk to know that while 66% of African Americans live in poverty, there are over 30 million more white people in raw numbers in poverty. Because what we want to do is to be able to go into eastern Kentucky, that's 99% white, and the Delta of Mississippi, and bring those communities together and help them understand that we can't do silo movements anymore, mm-hmm. where you address racism over here and poverty over here and ecological devastation over here and the war economy, because the one budget that keeps going up is the war economy. Mm-hmm. We for 53 cents yes. of every discretionary dollar is going into war, only 15 cents of every discretionary dollar is going into public education and health care. We have a draft now, it's called the poverty draft, right? If we just took $10 billion from the war machinery where we can already blow the world up about 50 times, we could solve so many problems. So you have to we have to address these things simultaneously, which is why we're not a left movement or a right movement or a conservative movement or a liberal movement, but a moral movement, doing moral analysis, moral articulation, and moral action to cut through these puny categories that people have put us in that automatically create division, right?
That's right.
And so we go into eastern Kentucky and we don't go up there and say, now we're going among the white people, we're not going to talk about race. We talk about race. Mm-hmm. And then we go in Delta and we say, well, you all are poor, but did you know you got some cousins in West Virginia with blue eyes and they just as poor? And we're trying to bring people together because America has always wanted the poor not to be engaged, mm-hmm. right? The economics, as you said, this a model, keep poor white men without land, mm-hmm. without power.
Yep.
Slaves keep them poor, mm-hmm. poor, even after slavery, poor. Don't open up power structures, keep immigrants poor. You know, Teddy Roosevelt in 1912 broke with the Republican and the Democratic Party and said there were moral issues we ought to be dealing with. Two of them, he said, was health care 100 years before Obama and a basic minimum living wage in 1912, right? When the Social Security Act was passed, President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, who was actually moved by a social gospel of Francis Perkins to do the right thing, mm-hmm. but he cut a deal with the Southern senators that said, you can have Social Security, but people in the agrarian culture and mm-hmm. people in the domestic culture can't pay in. Uh-huh. Well, 50% of white women were left out. Mm-hmm. So but there are forces that want us to be in silos, separate agendas, so they can play us against one another. And that's why our movement is taking this thing of putting people together. The other thing about the Dutch model is, right, the Dutch model, but it's mostly white. Mm-hmm. Right, that's what you're saying. And so we're trying to help people understand, again, a simplistic way, if you're poor, white, black, or whatever, there's certain realities that we all experience, but you can't say, is it race or is it class? You have to say, it is. It is race and class, not either or. And you can't extrapolate, separate them out. So that's important why leading the Poor People's Campaign as kind of the servant leaders is a white woman, Armenian, who had to sue to just be considered white in this country, and a white guy. Now, see how y'all froze on that?
I did see that.
But you know doggone well I'm part white, and I'm part Native American, and I'm part black. Now, I'm all black when I get stopped by the cops at night. But my point is, I have cousins that have blue eyes and blonde hair, as blue-eyed and blonde as anybody. So my whole heritage, some of it was through relationship and some of it was through rape. But be that as it may, I'm a compilation of a lot of parts. Some of it's negative, but the positive side of this is since I walk around with this diversity, then I ought to organize with this diversity. I ought to have a heart for this diversity. I ought to care about this diversity. And I believe that there are some people, we got some white folk in the movement that are stronger on the race question than some black people. And so it's important. And lastly, the narrative is so off. By Democrats and Republicans, for 50 years, politicians have fought at least 50 years to keep poverty out of the discussion and racism as political issues. Mm-hmm. So we had 26 presidential debates, right, in 2016. You got 43% of your population living in poverty, and you didn't have 1 hour debate on the Democratic side or the Republican side for presidential candidates about poverty. Less voting rights than we had since 1965, and you didn't have one, think about that, 26 debate, primary and general, and not one election. We have to have this movement, this political committee of the poor, I heard somebody talking about, that does whatever we got to do in the deepest moral and nonviolent tradition to break open the narrative. Because if you're not in the narrative in America, you're not in the game.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now we've got a lot of people lined up for questions, so we're going to do 3 questions over here and then let the panel discuss them. So if you could, 1, 2, 3, ask your question.
Well, my question is, I've noticed that both parties, Democratic and Republican parties, have both, they're both parties held to capital, but they're also parties that have taken part, including the Democratic Party, in killing social movements. So my question is, what advice do you have for the youth, not only in advancing the struggle for economic, ecological, political, and social justice, but also advising the fight against a system that creates and promotes not only ecological devastation, racism, xenophobia, sexism, that system that is capitalism. Do you have any advice for us, particularly the youth?
And the second question will be?
I wanted to know how much money each of us would have to donate tomorrow to your campaign that would really enable you to fund your next organizing effort, wherever it may be, because I'd like to be part of that, and I want to appeal to other people to do it as well. And I really mean it, because I've been a social worker for 14 years, and believe me, if you're not a social worker in this room, believe me, I am telling you, I've worked everywhere, and no amount of giving to charity will ever solve this problem. Charities actually become powerful with their money, and they keep large amounts of it at the end of every year so they can continue to operate and maintain themselves in luxury. Please, if you are giving to a charity, I would urge you as a social worker, just take my word for it. Give whatever money you're giving to charity right now and give it over to the Poor People's Campaign, because I am so, I'm just so tired of the whole game. Make these charities work for their money. If they're really meaningful, they will collapse. Please give your money to our guest tonight, and help prevent social worker burnout everywhere.
Did somebody touch that?
My third question. It's tape.
Yeah, we need that. We're gonna send that out. Yeah.
I don't know if I should go behind that, but it's a few things I want to say. I think the panelists and Reverend Barbara was at the point. What was it? When you had the conference?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Stony Point.
Stony Point, yeah.
Yeah, that was a great conference. And I also was in Washington when you had your first march. So what I want to say basically is this is really the first time I really feel safe that I can say this in this audience. But this is really the first time that I feel a little conflicted about voting. Now, when I was 18 years old, my parents, as soon as I turned 18, we was a voting family. You know, we voted, and I still believe in voting. I have never missed the election. But lately, I've been thinking, you know, even though we vote all the time, I'm saying, what change has really happened? Now, I'm not discouraging anybody for voting, but what I'm saying, especially because Democrats, you know, of course, I'm a Democrat, but I'm voting, but I'm saying we got to see how we can hold our politicians accountable. Still have the highest unemployment rate, African-Americans, you know, percentage-wise, and I'm saying we're doing all of this in poverty, so what is really changing? You know, they get our votes, but we have to make sure that they are held accountable so that they can help us.
Yeah.
Because we put them in office and they got a job, but what are they doing to help our situation to be better?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Okay, so those are our three.
So I got permission to ask the question as the fourth person because those two were little kind of statements, and really important ones. I'm Rabbi Bara Ellman. I'm actually a member of the Poor People's Campaign. I was with you in Washington the first time and at the last one on the anniversary of the Resurrection City. My question is actually kind of much broader and more basic. It seems to me from a lot of the work I've been doing in racial and looking at racial analysis and other things related to that, the fundamental problem seems to be that America has a sense of idea of individualism that is deeply flawed and that prevents us makes us think that we have autonomy rather than as being people who function in contexts that inform us. So what can we do to shift away from this Enlightenment idea of the autonomous person who can think objectively and is not a product of everything that came from them, and start to think more communally and more contextually? And I know that's not your campaign isn't doing that, but it's so much a part of what the campaign, I think, is connected to.
Okay, we got four.
Can I say something to her?
Okay.
Well, you want to go first? Go ahead.
Touch on one thing. This is something, I get a pushback on this. I'm not anti-capitalism, and people say, well, what do you mean? Capitalism is the most evil thing that ever happened. Slavery was here before capitalism. Slavery was here. The enslavement of people, the selling of their children, the raping of women to make more product was here before capitalism. I'm not blaming a particular system to say they are the root of all evil. When you had these systems under socialism, you had these things happening under all kinds of isms. Greed is what I'm talking about. The sense of a malignancy in a human being that they believe they can do these particular things. We could move out capitalism, call it something else, and people can still do evil things. I'd like to ask this very quick question, just to give you an idea what slavery is. If you work and you believe that your employer would work you for free if they could, please raise your hand. Thus, slavery. And if they could pass a law to say they could work you for free, and then if you complained about it, they could punish you through assault. That has nothing to do with capitalism. This has to do with the values of a society and the greed that this society decided to embrace in order to have people whom they were competing against be undermined as human beings so they could get that labor for free and then continue to be undermined through Jim Crow laws and then say there must be something about those people so unique they should be debased in this way. And then continue this debasement and the lies about these people time in and time out. Which then connects to the question that we just had. We have a culture, and I like to say this, I'm still annoyed about working from sun's uprise to sunset for free. I still have a problem with this. We have people who have a culture who, you know, and I'd say this for African Americans, I have a little mixture here and there too, I'm not running around claiming them, You know, but my thing is, you know, and I've met my relatives. I've actually met the descendants of the white family who own my family. And they're doing very well, so is my family, you know. It was weird, but we did that, okay? My concern is this. When African Americans who have a cultural, somewhat different type of society base, either based on what happened to us or based on where we were in our DNA, whatever it comes down to, this rugged individualism is not working for us. It is destroying our community. So for us to look at this society as rugged individualism, the American way, it's only the American way when you think about how they've undermined the competition of people of color and forced us into dealing in a cultural way that's not comfortable for our communities, and then turn around and say there's something wrong with us. America breaks people all the time and doesn't fix them.
Yep.
So okay. I want to, the last part I want is to go to the question about the politicians. And I have said many times, we can't just elect people. They show up at churches and synagogues, community centers, and they want to be elected, and then we give them 5 minutes. They don't even stay long enough for the sermon or to put anything in the plate. And then they're gone. It's up to us to force these politicians to keep their job. And then we have generation after generation of the same people, like this is some type of royal lineage that they're supposed to be in these offices. We need to understand if we don't force them, that's our fault. We have to feel at this point, and African Americans from 1965 after the Voting Rights Act have done a very fast learning curve had to be embraced by African Americans to learn the political system, become more sophisticated. In the 21st century, people of color have to be more sophisticated. Women have to be more politically sophisticated. Think Susan Collins. When you said, we want a woman, do you want another Susan Collins who voted in Brett Kavanaugh as a U.S. senator? That's why we have to be more sophisticated. And this last point I'm going to make, we have to stop being cheap political dates. Don't be a cheap political date. Get something for your vote. What are you asking for? How can you go to a politician to say you're disappointed me when you never asked that politician for something in the first place? I truly believe that formerly convicted people should have their own political action committee so that they can decide or at least influence criminal justice laws. But when people are running, that's when you ask them for things. You should ask them what they think about black empowerment, female empowerment. Ask them these questions when they're running, and instead of waiting until they're in office and push comes to shove, and then you find out what their real belief system is. Because like any date, they'll tell you anything in the beginning.
Oh, well. So So I'm glad we're having this conversation because it comes from different perspectives. So like when my sister mentions her relatives who were the slave owners, I happen to come from free issue blacks and on my father's side and Tuscarora Indians and whites who worked with black people to fight the systems of slavery. So I have to claim them because that was Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison. You know, that's that group of folk on my father's side. And part of what we're arguing is that we need to have a fusion coalition where it's not an organization. It doesn't mean you take away your silo or don't work in your silo, but you understand how your silo is impacted by the other silos. And here's the thing. If the same people attacking the incarcerated and not giving them their rights, when you look at the voting records, are the same people attacking the LGBTQ community, the same people taking your health care, the same people denying living wages, the same people taking your voting rights. If they are cynical enough to work together, why aren't we smart enough to come together? That's the genius of the Poor People's Campaign. It's saying, can't we interlock? You cannot take on interlocking injustice without an intersectional moral fusion coalition. A coalition where, Liz said a minute ago, people register for the movement and vote. I'm skeptical about voting. I'm skeptical about any politician because once they get elected, these systems have a way. So I know you can't vote and then go home. One of the things we did with the Tomorrow Monday movement in North Carolina is we built a movement that voted. So we had a voting arm, we had a legal arm, we had a civil disobedience arm, and it was all continuous for 5 or 6 years when they told us we couldn't beat back. The worst voter suppression law since 2013, the worst since Jim Crow, North Carolina was the modern day Selma. It took us 4 years, but in a fusion coalition, we beat them. We won. We took back, right? And we're about to have our first election in North Carolina without those laws, with changing the gerrymandering, some of the gerrymandering. We sent a governor home that was against us, but we had people from Appalachia to the East Coast, from the black counties to the white counties. You know, we formed an NAACP branches out west that were 90% white, but they were just as powerful and aggressive on the issues of race and whatnot. It can be done. Now, everybody won't do it, but somebody has to do it. Because you cannot find any revolutionary change in America that only happened because of one group working. It's just not historically accurate. You have to find the people that are connected together by these deep moral strands, this deep moral foundation. And when it comes to capitalism, you know, the scripture says, woe unto those who legislate evil. I don't care who they are. People can legislate evil. And then it says, rob the poor of their rights. Any system, I don't care what it is, that robs the poor of their rights and make women and children their prey. And this was the prophets talking 2,600 years ago, capitalism wasn't around. And they said, there are people, you have to challenge the system. And the young man said, you have to join movement, have a long-term view, be engaged, right? And stay with it. Democracy is hard work. Slavery had four underpinnings: evil economics, bad biology, sick sociology, and a heretical ontology. Bad biology, you born like this. Sick psychology, sociology, you shouldn't be around each other because skin color. Evil economics, the end justifies the mean. Heretical ontology, God meant it to be this way. You don't unpack that easily. Because that's not even a political idea. That's a religion. Huh? And you don't unpack a religion unpack it because it brainwashed people with just 1 year of struggle or 10 years of struggle or 100 years of struggle, because it keeps being rebirthed. So the movement people have to keep being rebirthed. And to my sister who said about rugged individualism, sure, rugged individualism is out here. How do you deal with it? You first of all, I say it, in some ways, pain is a great, can move you from rugged individualism. If you're in a foxhole and everybody getting shot at, and I think, I'm going to sound crazy, that's one of the blessings of Trump. Now, I'm a preacher. I have to learn to see the good in everything. And one of the blessings of Trump's symptoms and his enabler is that they are making the one mistake you never make in politics, and that is make everybody mad. Right? And so there are these pain moments throughout history that can be transformative. Like when the Dred Scott decision came down, people said the abolition fight was over, it was no need to run anymore. 3 months after it, Frederick Douglass looks at it and says, maybe some say that I should greet this unlooked and monstrous decision with sadness, but I greet it with cheer. For maybe this is the necessary step, preparatory step, in the full overthrowing of the slave system. The system, the anti-slavery movement is studied with proof that every action that they take, and I'm paraphrasing, to ally and stop the movement, instead emboldens, intensifies, and increases our agitation. This is the moment of pain for our movement to be emboldened, increased, and intensified. That's what I'm saying. Some of us, Lord help me, I don't want to say this the wrong way, but I'm including myself, need to stop whining. Folk fought through slavery. Don't you go around talking about this is the worst we've ever seen.
Yes, thank you.
Some of us need to grow a backbone.
Thank you.
Right? The Democrats need to grow a backbone. Progressives need to grow a backbone. And you don't vote right now. You have to vote for who you can best push. Right? Because you're not voting for Jesus. He already been elected king.
Thank you.
So you're not voting. So vote for who you can best push. And vote for who you are willing to stay on, right? That's what we have now. But for God's sake, 100 million people in this democracy can't sit out voting, and then we get what we got because of 77,000 votes. 100 million sat out, and we have what we have in the presidency because of 77,000 votes. You know, I'd vote for you over voting for him. I don't even know you. You don't even have to run no campaign. Anyway. They say.
All right, I think we've run out of time, unfortunately,
no.
So I want to thank our...
I know that. Here's what we need. If you really want to help us get 100,000 people to give $20 to the Poor People's Campaign. Now, that's not a lot out of 455 million. Tell everybody you know, if they could give 100,000 people to give $20 a month for the next 4 or 5 years, that will help us be able to fight these. How about that? And can we use your advertising?
I know, right?
I'm going to use, we need to get that.
Next month, first Thursday next month, Black Sports and the Struggle for Social Justice.
Book signing.
All right. We'll see you out in the hallway for the book signing.
It's 100,000. 100,000, I should have said.
Jane, you coming up for the shot?
Hello, everyone. If you're exiting the building, if you have a book and you've already purchased a book, you can exit the auditorium on this right side. If you're waiting to purchase a book or exiting the building, please leave through this left exit. Again, if you've purchased the book and want it signed, please leave on the right. If you would like to purchase a book from the gift shop and also exit the building, please leave on the left.